first thing I want just to underline, and everybody subconsciously knows it, that there are serpent images, cobra images, viper images, snake images in every society. And there's also the dragon. And people, and we're taught today that there's no evidence for the dragon. But it's very odd that you have this common sort of world myth that's everywhere, every continent, every culture knows about dragons. So let's just talk a little bit about that. So I'll make a case in the book that the angels, the dark angels who went to Mount Hermon and mated with human females, were seraphim angels. And they were part of a group that a lot of your people will be aware of, known as the Watchers, and in Greek they were known as the Grigori. Well, seraphim angels, not only some references in the Bible, which only seraph is in the Bible in Isaiah, refers to snakes. But seraphim angels were thought to look like snakes, like vipers. They had a face of a viper. And I'll bring some parallel and biblical references in the book to substantiate that. And their offspring, the Nephilim, looked just like them. So when you see in other cultures all of these images of gods that look like snakes and giants that look like snakes and all of this imagery, they were just producing art and keeping a record of their gods and the Nephilim. And so if you look at now the seraphim angel that has the face of a viper and you put wings on that, what do you have? You have a dragon. And if people look at the Eden incident, we look at the serpent losing its hands and its feet and its voice and had to crawl on the ground thereafter. Well, what's important to notice on that is that there's a lot of belief out there that there was more than just serpents that had hands and legs like a crocodile would have, or feet, let's say, 4 feet. But in prehistory, there's mythology that this animal actually walked on 2 feet and was bigger than a human being and was fairly intelligent. And I'll cover that off in the book as well. But that some of these forms of serpents before the Eden incident also had wings, which again would be an animal form of the dragon. So I think when we look at the dragon imagery, and we understand that the Nephilim looked just like them in the beginning, and that they usurped the kingships and the religions in both prehistory and after the flood, it makes sense that there's this dragon and serpent imagery everywhere. And if we look at the influence that the societies and mysticism have had throughout the millennia, again, it's not surprising to me that we see this imagery in fairy tales and in literature and in all of our entertainment, because they're the ones keeping this genealogy and information alive in different forms other than the genealogies. And people don't understand that this is not done just to entertain people. This is done to brainwash people in preparation for the end game so that they'll find it acceptable. And so when we look at all of these different aspects, you shouldn't be surprised that Dracula is telling the same story, drinking blood, which was a typical Nephilim portrait, to keep them immortal, yeah. Which the Nephilim originally were and want to be immortal, that the Christian church or the Catholic church is their mortal enemy. All of these allegories are encoded in, and if you walk through any of this type of literature, fairy tale or otherwise, what seemingly is innocent, what is seemingly outside the box, they're going to have the same religion and allegories and genealogies and secrecies in there. So if you get into King Arthur, if you get into Robin Hood, you're talking about the same thing over and over and over again. There's definitely a connection there, whether or not these are shape-shifting beings or not that would just take a human form. I guess that's possible. That would have to be fallen angels, in my opinion, who in a lot of beliefs have the shape-shifting capability. And I guess if there's really only one biblical reference where I'd say two, where that could be, one would be is if Lucifer, Satan, actually morphed into a snake to go into Eden. And the second one would be at the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, where the angels that were sent, the three of them, looked like human beings, and Abraham did not realize they were not human beings. So there's a belief that in the physical world, they can change their form, and they can also change sex, which means that they could have produced, let's say, a more angelic type of Nephilim that would be the lower gods in the polytheist pantheon, because all of the pantheons are the same, all comes from the same belief system and the same dark angels. So that can answer sort of that aspect of it. So I'll talk about fairies in the book significantly. And again, it's one of those things that comes up in all sorts of literature and entertainment. And again, for everybody, understand that that's there for a reason. And so in the fairy mythology, there were four different kinds of fairies. And so if you're into Tuatha De Danann and Celtic mythology, some of this is going to be fairly familiar with you. So there are the opalescent fairies that came to this planet from somewhere else and rebelled against God. And so they are translucent. You can sort of see through them, and they're a shining being. And then they produced another fairy through mating with human females, and they became the earthly fairies, who were shining beings as well. And for people that don't know the original Nephilim, their eyes shone. They actually glowed, and it was part of what made them scary. And you'll see that. That's why you see that in science fiction movies, let's say like Stargate series. That's why their eyes will glow. Okay, that's that same idea being kept alive again. And so below that, there are two sets of little people. And people will know the little people like the leprechauns or the gnolls, and there's several different subsets. And, and in the one set, there's three sets of little people. And inside one of those little people is a sect called the gray neighbors. Now, these gray neighbors have the same physical description as the gray aliens. These little fairies also had flying machines, and they kidnapped people. And they did. They were looking to reproduce with them to regenerate their gene pool. And they did other scientific things. And then they would return the people. And the people, it would say in fairy lore, after a fortnight, so let's say about 40 days, as I recall, a fortnight, and they would not have a memory of this. So I provide a description of fairy abduction in the book. And I think people find it startling as to how close it is to the aliens. So I think there's a connection in this all the way through. I know a lot of people believe that aliens are demons or fallen angels with that shape-shifting capability. That's certainly a possibility. I'm thinking that these little beings have been around since prehistory, and they also somehow survived the flood. Because again, in fairy mythology, you have these portals called knolls and mounds and fairy mounds. And in the Grail lore, the ladies of the lake protect the entrance to the portals to the other world. And in the alien mythology, many believe that UFOs come through these portals. So there's a direct connection in here all the way through. I think demons are here. They're the bodiless giants, where they're of the immortal first generation that weren't permitted into heaven and didn't go to sleep, and they continue to possess people and cause mayhem. But I also believe that these little people could possibly be beings that survived. And if you look at Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, and you see all of these little fairies and elves and things, it's quite a big part of the different sort of races that are in that story. And at the end of Tolkien's trilogy is these people are seen going away on a boat because it's the time of humankind. And that, again, is telling me that they're telling us messages of prehistory that they want to keep alive, that the people that they've enlightened or illuminated or educated or whatever know exactly what they're talking about, that somehow these beings also survived. So that's my take on it. Not only allegory, but the fairy bloodline that I'm going to connect through the in the book, and particularly as we get into the last parts of the book. And I'll distinguish between the dragon bloodline and the fairy bloodline. And I'll show how those branches fanned out and how they've rejoined. And one is the male patriarch bloodline, which is the dragon bloodline. And the fairy bloodline is the matriarch or the female bloodline of inheritance. And I'll bring those together.